This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So we left off at marriage and family. So the Prophet ﷺ had a reputation throughout Arabia, or throughout Mecca in particular, of being a very honest person. Now, a woman by the name of Khadija, she hired him to go and trade some of her merchandise in Syria. So Syria is one of the main places where the caravans would go, because there's a lot of merchandise over there. So she decides that she wants to go ahead and choose him. Why did she choose him? Because she's a smart businesswoman, and she says, you know what, let me get someone who's really, really known for his honesty. So she hires him, and he goes to Syria. He trades the merchandise that, you know, she sent him with. And on top of that, he takes some of that money and he buys more merchandise, and he comes back with that merchandise and he trades it back in Mecca as well. And he gives her all the profits, right? The extra profit that he didn't actually need to give her, he gave her part of that profit as well. Because the deal was that he just goes to Syria and he sells, you know, on her behalf, and that's it. The transaction is over. But he took some of the other merchandise which was on sale, bringing it back, selling that, and giving her extra profit. So she's really impressed. And she sent one of her employees along with him. Obviously, she's not a foolish woman. She does not just send, you know, a guy with all the money, some person she's never tested before. So she sends one of her employees along with him to go and make sure that, you know, he's handling everything. And when that guy comes back, he starts explaining to her. Says, this man that you hired this time, we've never seen anyone like him. And he started describing all the details about, you know, how the Prophet used to do this and he used to do that and all of these amazing things. And she was getting really impressed, you know. And she was just, wow, I didn't realize this guy's so amazing. And she says, yes. And she hears about all his qualities and everything. And then she goes and she kind of researches him. Like in the city, she knows about him, she's heard things about him, but the intimate stuff that, you know, she heard about, you know, when you travel with somebody, you get to know who they really are, right? When you hear something like, this is a very honest person, this is a very nice person, it's one thing. When you go and you meet them and you sit down with them for a few hours, it's another thing. When you travel with them for a few days in the middle of the desert, when there's hardship, maybe water's running out sometimes. Maybe, you know, it's not easy. When people, because traveling is a hardship, especially at that time. Even people today get annoyed when they're traveling. Imagine traveling through the desert at that time. When you're with somebody, you get to know what type of person they really are. You get to know their temperament. You get to know their behavior. When they're involved in business, you get to know what type of person they really are. All right? So, you know, The news comes back to Khadija, this is what the guy did. This is exactly what he did, this is his character, this is how he behaved. And she's just really, really interested, and this is amazing. This guy is not only a great employee to have, he would be actually a great husband to have as well. So she proposes to marry him. Okay, she proposes to marry him, and the thing is, remember this, she is his boss, right? She is a wealthy woman. He is not that wealthy. He doesn't even have capital of his own. He has to take other people's merchandise. But at the same time, he has to pay her a dower, or what they call dowry. He has to pay her a dower because that's what the culture is at that time. So he has to go and approach his other family members in order to raise some of the funds so that he can actually accept her proposal and get married. Which shows you what? Which shows you that, you know, it's another side lesson, you know, for the Muslim community in this time, is that if someone doesn't have the means to get married, generally the family was there to support them. But today, if you live in an individualistic society, the family says, you know what, you're on your own. Until you graduate, or until you get a job, or until you make money, you're not getting any help from anyone, from anywhere. It's a difficult situation. In the tribal society at that time, he was given help. So it's not like, even he wanted to get married, but he has to marry a woman from a high status, he had to bring a dowry. But he had to get help from his uncle and from his other family members as well at the same time. So they were married. Now Khadija was quite older than him. And this is important to know. So some sources say that she was 28, some sources say that she was about 40. Okay? So she could have been either. It's a big discrepancy, but for sure she's older than him. Right? At least by quite a few years. Maybe there's another source that says 30-something around there, whatever it may be. Now the thing is this. Men in that society, right, who were interested only in looks, and who were interested only in the sensual desires, what kind of women do you think they would be marrying? Younger women, right? Women who are much younger than them, or women who are kind of, you know, at their prime and all of that. And it shows you the type of person, the fact that he's accepting, shows you the type of choice he's making. He's making a choice that it's not just about the woman's looks. Although she was not a bad looking woman, she was a good looking woman as well. But since she was quite older, number one. Number two, she's been widowed twice. Meaning she's had two husbands before, she's had children before, both her husbands have passed away. Now, if you're a person who's looking for sensual pleasure and all of that, like people allege against the Prophet, does it look like you would go and marry someone who's already been married twice before? No, that's generally not what people in most societies would prefer. And he was 25 years old at the time. So he was still, you know, in his prime. He was still quite young at that time. And that's when he got married. Now, they have been married and they had six kids over a period of years. They had six kids, two boys and four girls. What happened to the two boys? They died in infancy. Right? They died in their infancy. Okay? But it just so happened that they were going to get some more boys in the family anyways. So there was a man by the name of Zayd ibn Haritha. He was a slave. And he was, how did he become a slave? He was captured during a raid on one city that he used to be from. And he was captured and he was taken, and somehow he ended up in the possession of Khadija because someone traded him and gave him her, and somehow they got that way. What did they do with the child? They adopted him as their own child, as their own son. Right? So it shows you what type of people they are. Khadija and Muhammad, what type of people they are, what kind of family they are. They adopted him as a son. Even though he was taken from another tribe and he was sold into slavery and all of these things. His story we will cover in detail in the second year in Islamic History 3. Inshallah, live companions of the Prophet. So now you have another boy coming into the family. It shows you his very important, his characteristics and his qualities. He could have kept the person, made him work, do whatever. He adopted him as a son. And he, even when he adopted him, he said, and he is going to inherit from me, and I'm going to, you know, he's going to inherit whatever, you know, we pass on to him as well. So full adoption, which was not allowed in Islam later on, but at this point in time, there was no revelation, there was nothing. Another thing ended up happening. There was a famine in Mecca. So famine means short supply of food, things are very difficult, economic hardship. So Abu Talib was undergoing economic difficulty. So they realized, like his family members, realized that he's in need of help. So they said, you know what, we want to go and we want to help you. Why don't you give us one of the children? We can take care of them, we'll feed them and everything. Because he had a lot of kids as well. And that is difficult in the family, you know, to feed another person, to take care of them. You have to have someone, you know, because the women were working at that time. They're outside, what do you call it? Milking the goats and the sheep and all of these type of things. So you have to, you know, take care of these things. So the Prophet ﷺ and Khadija, they took Ali into their household. And Ja'far, who was another child of Abu Talib, was taken into another household. And we'll talk about Ja'far later. Just know that two of the children were taken away from Abu Talib just to help him during his time. Why is all of this important? It's important because they were a happy family of eight people. Despite the fact that they had lost two sons, right? Four daughters, two kind of sons, one in the household, one adopted, and husband and wife, right? So we're talking about a family man, right? When people go and they look at, you know, presidential candidates, and when they look at, you know, who should we vote for, who should we look into, what is one of the things that they look at? They look at, is this a family person, right? Does this person, because when you're just a lone shark or a lone ranger, you know, one of those kind of things, you may have certain talents and certain abilities, but people in society want to see that, you know what, can you handle your family? Can you take care of your wife? Can you take care of your kids? How are you with them and all of that? It's a very important thing in that society, and it's still a very important thing in many societies. So they were a happy family, normal family, just living, you know, doing their thing. Not worshipping idols, but at the same time, just living their own life and doing their own thing. Okay? Any questions so far? Khadija had kids before. What exactly happened to them, we don't exactly know. You know, maybe the, you know, family, perhaps the tribe took them back because they say they belong to the maternal side. The paternal side. That happens in many tribal societies. Maybe the kids passed away, died in a war. We don't know exactly what happened to them. How much does it convert to in dollars? To be honest, I don't know, but it's enough that he couldn't afford it and he needed help. It's enough that he needed help, yeah. So, and that's equivalent. It's either this or it was in a certain amount of camels that was given, this equivalency. So exactly how much it was, but just know that it's a pretty large amount. Not an excessively ridiculous amount that no one can afford it, but it was pretty decent amount. All right, okay, so someone can say, well, he might have married her for money. And people have made that accusation recently. Not in the past, but recently they've made this accusation. Now here's the thing. If you look at the person's character, right? If he was interested in money, and he has the reputation for being the most honest, and he's getting a lot of business because he's trading on behalf of other people, if he was so concerned about money, he didn't know he's going to get this kind of opportunity, right? You could have taken all the merchandise, say, you know, I'm the most honest person, everything, go to Syria and never come back. He could have done that. A lot of people will do that, scam artists and all of that. So if he was interested in money, he could have done that. If he was interested in money, he could have gotten money from different means. He could have done other things. The thing is, you don't judge a person's reputation. Like there's a Christian woman, her name was Annie Besant. She was writing a book for Christian missionaries and explaining to them that, look, before you start attacking the Prophet, why don't you do a little justice to the man? And she's writing and she says, you don't judge people's lives this way. That a person who you start attacking his reputation for being obsessed with, you know, sensuality and all of that, when the guy doesn't exhibit any interest in the desires of the world, he doesn't exhibit any interest in other women, any loose relationships, nothing like that, you don't judge him, then all of a sudden he takes a second wife and you say, oh, he must be doing it only for sensual reasons. You don't judge people's lives like that. The same thing applies, is that if you see somebody, great character, no immoralities, they're always honest, they're always just, they're helping other people, they're doing everything great, and then all of a sudden, they go and they do one thing, they marry someone who happens to be wealthy. Number one, he didn't propose, she proposed to him, right? A very important thing. He didn't even go and seek her out. Right? He could have gone and sought out and say, who's the wealthiest woman in the city? Let me go and propose to her. He didn't do that in any sense at all, right? So you don't judge people's lives. That's basically what it is. It's a very simple thing. You could take anyone and you can say, you know what? This happens in society. There's two ways to interpret people's actions. You see a person's very, very nice, right? Very kind, very friendly and everything. And then you see that he's sitting with some children around them and, you know, he's patting the kids on the back, right? If somebody from afar doesn't know this person's character, what can they accuse this guy of doing? Child molestation. Why are you putting your hands on that kid? He can go to jail. He can go to jail in this community. In this society, he could go to jail. If he put his hand the wrong way and the kid said, no, he touched me, he moved his hand from here, he moved it a little bit, you know, forward. He can go to jail. But if you know a person's character, you don't judge people like that. Because the guy could either be doing what? He could either be touching the child out of love, so now you're not allowed to touch children anymore. Because if you touch them, you're going to be accused of something like that. We don't make judgments that way. So it's very, very important. I'm glad you asked this question. People can make all sorts of accusations against anybody, right? If somebody goes and you see somebody and you see somebody helping another person take their groceries out of their car and help them in, you can make the simple accusation and say, you know what? He probably wants something from her. Right? The old lady, he probably wants something from the old lady. Maybe he's hoping that the old lady dies and leaves him some inheritance. Right? Yeah, you can make a story, right? But is there any basis to the story? No, because you have to have some solid evidence for it. So if somebody makes accusation, oh, he did it for the money. Okay, take that as a hypothetical, logical possibility. Is there any other evidence that exists at all that that would be the reason? If he's a person who's not interested in money, when they got married, he continued to work for her, he didn't retire. Right? He didn't retire, he didn't sit back and go on vacation. Okay? He moved into her household, he didn't go and take her money. In Arabian society, he could have divorced her, gotten the money and ran away, but he didn't do that either. So there's no basis to support it. So it's very important that we have a knowledge about the surrounding circumstances so that this logical possibility doesn't start becoming like, oh yeah, it could be this, and it could be that, and it could be that. So it's very important the difference between could be and probably is. That's the way we judge people. That's the way we judge people, right? You can do that with everything, you know. The guy comes and shakes your hand, he shakes your hand hard. Oh, maybe he's attracted to me, you know. Right? Problem, right? Muslim guy comes and hugs the guy. He's probably coming on to me. You could say that, but say, no, that's just his culture. He's trying to show his love. That's not the way it works, right? So we have to be careful about these things. Any other questions on this slide? Okay. Rebuilding the Kaaba. Another very important incident happened. When he was around age of 35, the Kaaba was damaged by flooding. Now think about why the Kaaba would be damaged by flooding. First of all, you're in a desert. There's not that much rain. But when there is rain, it can get pretty hard. Now, Mecca is a valley, right? What is the definition of a valley? Surrounded by hills, exactly. What happens when it rains and the water goes down the hill and you're happen to be here and all the mountains are like this, the hills are like this. The water is going to rush down the mountain and hit it. Direct impact, right? This is what actually it happened to me when we were in Mecca. It started flooding one time because the water just comes down really fast. That's the way it is because it's a valley. And at that's before the demolition of the hills recently. Imagine at that time when there were even more hills. So water is coming down. It started to damage the Kaaba. Okay, it began to damage the Kaaba. The Kaaba, you know, had a little bit weaker foundation. And remember, the Kaaba at that time when it was built by Prophet Ibrahim, you know, it was smaller and less stable and less sturdy. Not less sturdy, but it was smaller than what was what existed later on. It was built with stones and everything, but there was some wood that was used as well in the Kaaba, so it was damaged. So it needed renovation. It needed to be repaired and it needed to be fixed up. So what happened? This is coming back to your question about how did the Quraysh know about immoral vices and immoralities in the community. They decided that we're only going to use pure money to rebuild the Kaaba. So they said, meaning they had a concept of pure and impure money. What is impure money? Impure money is money from gambling, money from prostitution, and money from usury, meaning interest. They knew that there was kind of something wrong because people were doing these kind of things, no stolen money, none of that. They said, we're only going to use clean money. Because this is the Kaaba, you know, they still venerated it. It was still a very important thing for them. So they proceeded to, you know, start reconstruction. And what ended up happening was all the tribes got together, everyone's rebuilding the Kaaba, everything's going fine. Up until there's one point where the black stone, where there was this stone in the corner of the Kaaba, needed to be put back into its place. And this debate, you know, arose. This dispute broke out. And everyone wanted to have the honor of placing this black stone. Now, why is the black stone so special at this point in time? Because it's the marker which indicates where you start going around the Kaaba from. From their perspective, at this point in time, that's the marker. That's where you start from, and that's where you end. So that's the only thing that's kind of distinguished in the entire building. The entire building is just a bunch of bricks, right? A bunch of stones and everything else. It's got a cover. There's nothing else in the building that you could fight for. So they had to fight for something. So what did they fight for? They said, you know what? This is the only thing that looks kind of is important and it's, you know, something different. Let's go ahead and fight for the honor of this. So they started fighting for this and they said, you know what? Our tribe or our clan should have the honor of placing the black stone. And they said, no, no, no. It should be our clan. Everyone wanted honor. It's about respect and it's about honor. So each clan started demanding this. And one clan, they were, you know, they were really determined. Like other clans, they're kind of like, yeah, no, 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 we should do it. Other clans, no, no, we should do it. One clan just kind of really got excited. So, no, no, no. They brought a bowl of blood and said, we're going to fight you and we will fight till the death. We're ready to die just to put this black stone. That's the way they were. They would just kind of get riled up, you know. So they got riled up, and one clan, they brought a bowl of blood. They dipped their hands in it. And they allied with another clan, and they dipped their hands in it as well. They say, we're together. We're both going to do it together. We'll fight anyone who's going to try and take this honor away from us. So they're ready to fight till the death. And so war was almost about to break out in the reconstruction of the Kaaba. So this shows you the kind of people that they were, right? This is their holy building, right? They venerate it, they respect it and everything, and now they're ready to go and have a battle right in front there, just for the personal, selfish honor of putting the black stone in place. So they mixed religion with selfishness and with culture and with honor and with all these things which happen in every religion and things which happen today in many societies still. So people will mix even what they believe to be the correct religion with other things that, you know, selfish desires and interests. So what ended up happening? They decided on arbitration. So one of the eldest members of the, you know, of the Quraysh there, he said, look, we've had enough wars. We don't need another battle. We don't need another war. There's no point in shedding blood. Let's resolve this in another way. But everyone is competing. So how do we resolve this? We need a third party. So let's go ahead and say, the next person who comes to visit the Kaaba will decide which one of us gets the honor. Right? So now how does this work? So this works in this way. Why would they agree on this? Because they felt that whoever comes to visit the Kaaba on a regular basis is a special person, is a person who's worshipping, who's following the religion. Right? Everyone else is at the marketplace and doing everything. So they say, you know what? The next guy who comes to visit, you know, he's coming to pray. They assume for the idols, right? He's coming to pray at the Kaaba. We're going to select him. So from their mentality, they're saying, you know, that's great. That's perfectly fine. You know, the next guy, he's a pious person because he's coming to the Kaaba at this time of the day. We'll go ahead and say, whoever it is, we'll go ahead and allow them. Now, another thing in their mind was that we'll let this person decide, meaning that person who comes, whatever tribe he's from, or whatever clan he's from, he's obviously going to pick his own clan. So basically what it means is the next clan member to walk in gets to decide who it's going to be. So what do they see? They see the Prophet coming, and he's walking. And immediately they start shouting, Al-Amin, Al-Amin, the trustworthy, the trustworthy. His nickname was Al-Amin, which means the trustworthy, the one you can trust. The one that people put their trust in because he's so reliable, he's so honest. So they started shouting that because they were so happy. Why were they so happy? Because they were hoping and they were thinking that he's not just going to pick his own clan. Because they said, this guy's honest, you know, this guy, he's gonna come up with something good, you know. So they waited for him. So what did he do? He heard the situation and he said, bring me a cloth or a cloak or something like that. And he said, he placed the stone on top of it and he said, every single clan is going to pick up one side of the sheet and they're all going to carry it together to the place where it's going to be, and I'm going to pick it up and put it in place myself. And they had no problem with that because he was selected to place it, but he allowed all of them to participate. So everyone got the honor of participating. Everyone was happy. So this shows you that he took a policy of compromise. Rather than choosing his own clan, or rather than saying that this person has the right to do it, he was supposed to decide which one of them gets to do it. And he had to make a judgment call, and he did it in a way that all of them got to do it. Showing you the importance, or the ability, his ability to unite people, rather than divide them. So everyone was happy, everyone was, you know, this is great, everything is going great, everyone was happy. Now, what are some of the lessons from this incident? We're trying to focus on the life of the Prophet. So one of the lessons we have is, it shows you his status in Arabia. How does it show his status? Right? Not only was he known to be Al-Amin beforehand, but even at the age of 35. So he was known as the trustworthy before his marriage, before the age of 25. This was not just a period of popularity. A period of like he had a fan club or something like that. This lasted up until he was 35. That's a very long time to maintain yourself in that reputation where probably people were looking at you and just waiting for you to mess up. When you have a reputation that high, people are just waiting for some kind of blemish on your reputation so that you mess up. He didn't mess up and he still had that reputation among society. And number two, it shows you his ability to overcome tribalism. It was not about tribe. Why is that important again? Because again, you know, I've been reading a lot of this stuff. That's why I keep mentioning this. There's a lot of stuff out there who, you know, that people are writing that the Prophet was trying to put his tribe back into power when he came with the revelation of the Quran and when he came with Islam. And obviously, if he was doing that, he wouldn't be doing things like this. So it kind of gives you a little bit perspective of how he really was. Now here's the problem though. The problem was the Kaaba was shortened because they ran out of clean money. So they didn't even have enough money. So they ran out and said, you know, we got left this prostitution money. We got this other money. They didn't even have enough clean money to build the entire thing. So the Kaaba was shortened. So it was more rectangular in nature, and now it became more cubic in nature. And what did they do instead? They built a short semicircular wall going around because they couldn't build it all the way to the top because they ran out. They didn't have supplies left. So the wall, but what they did was, before they did that, they thought everything was going to be fine. So they actually started building the walls higher on three parts. The walls were much, much higher than before. Double, if not more than double. They raised the door. So the door to the Kaaba originally was on the floor. And they actually raised the door, so now it's in the same way it is today. The door is higher. Why did they raise the door? So that they could control who's allowed inside the Kaaba and who is not allowed. So they wanted some control, so they made this modification. Number three, they added a roof, right? There was no roof in the Kaaba initially. Why did they add a roof? Because people used to come and put treasures and stuff inside the Kaaba. But if it has no roof and if it's so short, you just jump over and you steal the treasure and you jump out. Very easy. So they wanted to deter thieves from going and stealing stuff inside the Kaaba. And also for like, you know, they saw that there was a flood. Imagine it goes inside, water gets trapped inside. It's a problem for the structure itself of the Kaaba. Okay? Any questions on that? So the question about the semicircular wall was originally part of the original Kaaba. That's why when you're standing now, if you go inside that area, you're technically inside the Kaaba. That's why everyone wants to pray in there nowadays. Because technically you're actually are inside the Kaaba. The real dimensions of the Kaaba. Most wars were fought between tribes, not between clans. But this was a case where they wanted the honor, so they were ready to, you know, they were ready to go. And there were some other tribes. There was not only one tribe in Mecca as well. There was probably some other tribes were involved as well here. Yes, so the question is, was there something else special about the black stone? So there are some reports about the black stone being from heaven. And there are some reports about the black stone having sins and all of that. The main report is that Prophet Ibrahim was looking for another stone to finish the building, and he was not able to find that stone. So he found this stone specifically. So in a sense, it was sent by Allah, in a sense. So that's pretty much what it is. So I know that there's a lot of other, you know, biographies that talk about the details of the black stone and what it means and sins and all of that, but there's some conflicting evidence regarding the authenticity of that report. Okay, how does raising the door to the Kaaba control who can come in and out? Well, because, you know, when the door is open, if the door didn't have a lock on it, or the door is open and it's on the floor, everyone can just kind of rush in and go in, and you can't, it's very hard to control. If the door is raised up there and you have to kind of walk up the steps, everyone can see that you're just kind of walking in. So it kind of gave them more of a sense of control. I mean, a lock would do the same thing, but a lock with a raised thing so that people can't just walk in gives you a better sense of control. Okay. Yeah, so I mean, so from the time of Prophet Ismail, did the Kaaba stay until the time of the Prophet as is? But there could have been another modification as well. It was not completely damaged and then rebuilt. Yeah, this was not like, it's not like it's gone. It was just damaged. They were rebuilding it and they were making some modifications to it. Maybe some other modifications had taken place. I don't recall. Throughout history afterwards, there have been more modifications, right? But in terms of before that, I'm not sure. So, yes. Okay, continuing. So, now the Prophet ﷺ is up until, from the age of 35, we're kind of around that area. He's living a very simple life, okay? There's no revolutionary movements that he's, you know, trying to, you know, instill in the society. He's not trying to, you know, get people riled up and like take control or anything like that. He's not interested in any of these things. And he's not alone. in his worship, by the way. So he's not the only person who's rejecting idol worship. There are a few people. Okay? Now keep in mind that the word few actually means few. Doesn't mean many. Unfortunately, some people who are writing books today, they think that the word few means many. So they think they're writing actually that if the Prophet did not come, if the Prophet did not come, then Arabia would have gone towards monotheism and idol worship was already going to go away anyways. In fact, one of the former directors of the CIA, he wrote a book called A World Without Islam. Anyone read that book? You heard about the other book or movie, World Without, what is it, Mexicans or something like that, Latinos? You heard of that one, right? Okay, so he wrote a book based upon that called A World Without Islam. And in the first chapter, the entire argument, and this is an intelligent man. I mean, this is, we're talking about CIA. We're not talking about just some random person. But he kind of picked up on some sources and started arguing that, no. Everyone in Arabia was already on the way towards monotheism. They were kind of going away from idol worship anyways. And that's exactly the opposite. So actually the opposite was there was a few people, a few exceptional people who actually had already gone away from idol worship. And we're going to mention these few people. Okay? Number one, Waraqa ibn Nawfal was one of them. He was a Christian. He was one of the few people in Mecca who had adopted Christianity. And he was able to read the scriptures as well. Meaning he could read the Jewish scriptures, he could read the Christian scriptures, he knew Hebrew, he knew Greek, and obviously he knew Arabic, he could read and write, all of these things. So Waraqa was one of those people who could do it, and he was known to do that. Zayd ibn Amr ibn Nufail was another one. And he was a person who was searching. How did he get to where he was? He was a person who was searching. So what did he do? He went to Syria. He's traveling around and he says something is wrong with my idolatry of my people. So he goes to Syria and he meets a rabbi. And he asks the rabbi a number of questions, trying to figure out, you know, what do you believe and what are your questions and everything. The rabbi gives him some answers and he says, you know, I can't accept that. You know, that doesn't make sense to me. So he continues searching. And he goes and he meets a priest, right? And the priest, he starts asking him similar questions. What is your religion about? What do you guys do? All of these things. And the priest gives him some answers as well. And he says, you know, that's weird. I can't follow this religion. This doesn't make sense to me. Right? So he makes a statement, and this statement was remembered by some people later on. He said, O Allah, I declare that I follow the religion of Prophet Ibrahim. That's what he said. He doesn't know, right? He knows that Prophet Ibrahim was not worshipping idols. So he's one of the people who figured it out, right? But he said, I want to follow these other things, but the way they explain their religion, this can't be right. This can't be the real religion. So something is definitely wrong. So then while Zayd was at the Kaaba, he used to announce, and he used to say, none of you follows the way of Ibrahim except me. So he's one of the people who was he was a vocal critic. He was one of the few people who used to speak out and say that you guys are on the wrong path. The Prophet didn't do this, but he used to do this to some people. He used to speak out. And another thing that he used to do is he used to rescue the little girls who are about to be buried alive. So you have, for example, you know, we talked about how children, how fathers, when they gave birth to a child, a young girl, they wanted to bury that girl alive. So what did he used to do? He used to go and he used to go to the father and say, look, don't bury her, don't kill her. If you want, I'll take care of her. So he would go and he would become like this adoption agency, and he would adopt all of these little girls, and he would bring them up. Now, beyond that, he would go and he would, once they got raised up a little bit older, he would go back to the parents and say, now, you see your daughter, the one that I saved, your daughter she's older now, she can kind of work on her own, she could do some work in the house, she's not just a burden on you. Would you like her back? If you want, you can have her back. If you want, I can keep her and continue to raise her. A great guy. A very, very important guy. And this guy actually died before the Prophet received revelation. But the Prophet said about him that he's going to be in paradise. He's going to be in paradise. Why? Because he figured out on his own. He was searching for a religion. He was searching for the truth. But he couldn't figure out exactly what it was. So he started worshipping Allah in any way. In any way that he knew. And one of the things before he died, One of the statements that he made before he died, he said, "Oh Allah, if only I knew how to worship you, I would have done so. If I knew how to worship you, I would have worshipped you. But I don't know. I don't know." What does it tell you? A very important lesson is that, yeah, I know this, the hail or something is bothering, but it's not that amazing, to be honest. Alhamdulillah, it's happening. But it shouldn't distract you away from the class. Right? This I know, I've lived in the UK and France, perhaps I'm used to this. But don't worry, it's not, you can concentrate, inshallah ta'ala. This is your test of patience, of sabr, or concentration, inshallah. So, this teaches that before the revelation had come, there were people who figured out that idolatry and these things were wrong, number one. Number two, there were a few people who were searching for the truth. And the fact that they were searching and the fact that they arrived to part of the truth, Allah rewarded them for that and gave them paradise because the revelation had not come yet. It's very interesting. And in fact, his son became one of the first Muslims. So we're going to talk about that later. We'll probably talk about that in next year's class, Islamic History 3. So, he used to rescue little girls. At the age of 40, the Prophet ﷺ, who's not a prophet yet, he begins to go on retreats. Okay, he begins to go on retreats, spiritual retreats by himself. Okay, this is very important in and of itself. Okay, you're 40 years old, you have 7 members in your family, wife and 6 other people at home, right? You are from a very important tribe, you're from a very important clan, your uncle is one of the most respected people in the entire city, finances are pretty good because your wife is quite wealthy and the trading business and everything was going good. Okay, now imagine what would most people do if they were in this circumstance. They would either get into politics, try to see how they could, you know, move up the chain of popularity within the clan and everything. He has a good reputation. He could start running for, you know, future chief or whatever it may be. These are very, very common things that most people would be doing. And instead, what does he decide to do? He decides to leave his family for a while and start going in the mountains on retreats by himself. And he starts worshipping Allah because he believed in Allah. And number two, he's kind of reflecting upon society, reflecting on things. But it's very important to understand that he believed in Allah, like all the other Arabs, but he did not associate, you know, partners. He did not have idol worship. So he's not like some people may take him to be like a René Descartes, you know, philosopher going in the mountain and thinking things out. No, he's worshiping and he's thinking at the same time. There's a difference between the two of them. So he's doing both. Okay, he's doing both. And he goes, he's worshiping and he's reflecting on the purpose of life by himself. What ends up happening is he started doing this as a side occupation, right? Side kind of break. I'm going to go take my time out there and get some, you know, figure out what's going on, worship Allah and come back. This is while he's working. Then he starts going and becomes regular and regular. He starts doing this more and more often. Then he leaves. His job is over now. He stops working and he's only focusing on this. He goes, he comes back, gets some more food, and he goes for another number of days. He comes back, gets some food, goes for another number of days. This is seclusion that he's in. He's in seclusion and he's going on these things. Another thing that's happening during this time is now that while he's worshiping and while he's praying and while he's reflecting, he starts having dreams. And these dreams that he has, they start coming true exactly the same way that he saw the dream. Exactly what he sees in the dream, it happens. What does that mean to him at this point in time? He doesn't know. He doesn't know. He has no idea what it means. He has no idea what's going on. But he's searching for guidance. This is the important thing. He is there. He's praying to Allah. And like Zayd who just died and said, "Oh Allah, I don't know how to worship you." He's doing the exact same thing. And he's asking Allah, "Allah, guide me. I don't know. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to worship. I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. Guide me." This is where we'll stop here. And we'll talk about the revelation, inshallah, in the next session. Any questions on this slide? Yeah. All right. So the question is that there's a claim that the Prophet studied with the Christians, right, or with some Christian scholars or something. And that's why there's a lot of similarities between the Quran and between the other thing. Now, they're referring to a journey where he met a monk named Bahira when he was 12 years old in Syria with his uncle, when he was going on journeys with his uncle. Now, if that's true, then that means that at the age of 12, he mastered Christian theology, which the church themselves couldn't do because they were debating back and forth about, you know, divinity of Christ and Council of Nicaea and Council of this and Chalcedon and all of these councils. And from that period until the age of 40, he never talked about anything, right? And he couldn't read and write, so he couldn't transfer any of his thoughts anywhere. And then all of a sudden, he comes with all of that, remembering back 28 years prior, coming back with all of that. The claim itself is extremely far-fetched, number one. Number two, when you compare what the Bible has and you compare what the Quran has, you find major differences in major things. Minor things and major things. And the fact that there's major differences and the theology is consistent, the theology is, the stories are different, everything is different, you find that there's no way, you cannot say it's a copy, right? Because if it's a copy, basically most people who have major issues with certain biblical narratives, that's missing from the Quran. The problems and the issues that most people have are gone. So it would usually take like a professor, someone with a PhD to kind of clean up the entire story, to know the entire story, to know the entire history. It's very unlikely, that's one. And number two, the books of the priests and the rabbis at that time were only in the possession of those people. So if he's illiterate and he's not in that priestly, you know, kind of, you know, status, he doesn't even have access to these books. So there's a lot of different ways to debunk this claim, but that's just some of them. That's just some of them. Okay, any other questions? Okay, perhaps in Mecca, there were no Bibles written in Arabic. There is evidence that there were some scriptures of the Bible in Arabic in different parts. Because the thing is, remember that there was Christianity on the borders of the Roman Empire. So it's very likely that some of it had been translated into Arabic, right? And in fact, I forgot which date, but there is a text which combined all four Gospels together, and it's in an Arabic-like language, if not Syriac or something like that. So there was. But in terms of having the entire Bible or the entire Gospels that other people had, not likely to have the entire thing in Mecca for sure. So that's definitely true. Definitely true. Good question. So why is it that he left his family behind and he's worshipping in the cave? First of all, he spent how many years with his family so far? 15 years, right? He's doing this at the age of like 39 and 40. And in the beginning, he's regularly going to visit them. It's not like he's not going back and spending some time with them. See, spending time with family is about quality time. It's not just about quantity time, right? So you can sit in front of the TV with your family and say, well, we spent all day together. That's not quality time, right? So he was a person, obviously, who spent quality time with his family. And there were certain times while he was gone. And when he becomes a prophet, we're going to find that he's going to be extremely busy. But it's the quality time that he's spending with his family that no one is complaining about it. That's the way life was. People travel on business trips. If he's traveling to Syria, he's not just going for a few days and coming back. It takes a long time to get to Syria, long time to get to Yemen, trade the merchandise, come back. That's the way life was. So one is that he spent quality time with his family. And two, families perhaps were not so picky about, you know, you have to be with me all the time, you can't go for one day or 2 days or something like that, you know. So the question is that Fatima was the only daughter, according to some people. No, Fatima was the only surviving daughter. That's the difference. Yeah, only surviving daughter. That outlived him. That outlived her father. Okay, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us and guide us to learn the lessons from the life of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and to be like him and to follow in his example and to apply what we learn. Ameen. Subhana rabbika rabbil izzati amma yasifun. Wassalamun ala al-mursaleen. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Assalamu alaikum.